supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Earlier this week, the Franklin Institute's Night Skies Observatory program featured a special guest, Dr. Hakeem Oyusheyi, astrophysicist, cosmologist, inventor, professor, and author. On this episode of Sky Talk, he joins me and Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Dr. Oyusheyi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I am honored to be here.
Well, indeed, in part because I understand you got some of your first interests in science through public broadcasting.
Absolutely right. Yeah. So I used to stay home and watch television, and I watched PBS. I would watch Jacques Cousteau. I would watch Wild America. And if you met little, you know, 6-7-year-old me and you asked me what I wanted to be, the first thing I would have said was a zoologist. And the second thing I would have said was an oceanographer.
You're at the forefront of what's happening in the world of cosmology and astrophysics. What do you see as the next big challenge?
Yeah, the next big challenge has been a challenge for a while. And so I see three things that really jump out. And two of them, I don't really see us anything on the horizon as the answer being provided tomorrow. The other one, the answer could come any day. All right. So those three things are dark matter, dark energy, and life in the universe. And the last one is the one that I think we may see headway on in our lifetime.
Now, there's life, but yeah. How about sentient life with a right. Self-awareness of what we are and what this is all about?
Right. Well, what I see is that the life around us has detectors, right? It has chemical molecule detectors. We call it a tongue and a nose. It has photon detectors. We call them eyes, right? We can detect vibrations as sound in the air or as feeling. So why not? It seems to be a natural consequence of the process, okay? Now, astronomically, the question is, can we observe them? And so one recent thing that I realized is that even if there is sentient life, the probability of observing that sentient life may be a lot lower than what we originally believe. And here's why. I think that the Earth, as we look around and we see where atmospheres exist, they're typically incredibly thick, right? So we have the gas giants in our solar system, or gas and ice giants, but the four terrestrial planets with atmospheres, right? You have Earth, Mars, Venus, and Titan. All right. Mm-hmm. Mars's atmosphere virtually doesn't even exist.
Right.
And it doesn't have a magnetic field. Right. Mm-hmm. So radiation penetrates 6 feet under the ground at Mars. OK. Venus and Titan, if you're on those surfaces, you don't even know that there are stars in the universe.
Too much cloud.
Too much cloud. Yep. It just doesn't get
through. So
they
can't see the sky.
They can't see the sky. Right. But here on Earth, we have this barely existing atmosphere and a giant magnetic field that protects it from eroding away too quickly. So that set of conditions, as well as having surface liquids, is very uncommon because, you know, I think that the thing to look for life is liquids, because you have to, for these chemical reactions, you need liquids. And if you have liquids, that means you have the right temperature. That means you're protected from radiation. So where do liquids occur? Only Earth and Titan have surface liquids.
Right.
Typically, liquids and oceans are locked under miles of ice. Right? So if a species evolves there, then they're going to be either trapped under miles of ice, right? They're going to be aquatic, or you're under this thick atmosphere. Now let's take it another level. When we look at the terrestrial planets that have been discovered, what's the most common type? Super Earths. Okay, so gravity is way stronger. So let's assume then that we have this rare Earth situation achieved, that there is a planet out there where there are surface liquids and a transparent atmosphere, but it's a super Earth, big mass, big gravity. So that means that these beings won't be tall because of the strong gravity. All right, they're going to be short. And also compared to us on Earth, they're going to be really strong. So it's going to be little tiny Incredible Hulks. That's what the aliens are, these sentient beings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the number of super Earths that we're starting to find more and more of these super Earths out there, they seem to be far more common than the normal size Earth as we see it right now.
And yet you're surmising that it might be easier to find one of these incredible hulks than it is to definitively identify dark matter or dark energy. Why?
Well, there's a history in science of problem arises, solution arises. Okay. So now, dark matter, dark energy. You make predictions, you go and look, oh, can't find it. It's not there. What's going on? Why is it so difficult to find relative to everything else we've predicted and looked for? It's because there's something that we're just not getting. And all these pieces of evidence are telling us, and you know, physicists accept this, we really don't get space and time yet. We, you know, Albert Einstein brought us way closer than we were, but we're not there yet.
Your belief in the scientific method and your passion is evident. To what extent are you frustrated that in 2019 so many either don't know about the Big Bang Theory or just say out of hand, oh, that couldn't be correct?
Yeah. Well, you know, there is the absolute measurement and there is the relative measurement, right? And so, for example, politically, one of the things that we've dealt with in our society is, you know, issues of racial injustice, right? And so people have found, like, depending on if you're an African-American or a white American, you see it different. Why? Because African-Americans look at this ideal of everybody being equal and free, and that's the comparison. Whereas, you know, the average white American will look at the relative measurement. Oh, look how things were jacked up before. They're so much better now, right? And so it makes a difference if you're looking at it relatively or absolutely. So absolutely, yeah, you know, the average human, you know, the average person doesn't know this stuff like a scientist does. But relatively speaking, I think that's a big misconception. I think that we've never had so many people interested in science. We have armies of scientists now, right? Armies. There are thousands of astronomers and cosmologists around the world.
What's the status of your project to have good telescopes in every country in the world?
Well, you know, actually, it's weird because that project really didn't exist. So I was doing a lot of work developing astrophysics research, physics research, and science education on the African continent. And I started interfacing with a lot of the Western world, bringing them into Africa, because a lot of people thought, oh, there aren't even scientists, right? And if there are scientists, mm-hmm. they're probably mm-hmm. not good. And, oh, no, they're actually really good, right? They're just broke. And, you know, the nations couldn't support basic research the way, you know, Western nations could. So my first TED Talk, TEDx Orlando, I gave this talk, The Big Bang, How Do We Know, right? And the organizers of that conference said, Hakeem, you should apply to be a TED Fellow. And I'm busy, right? I'm like, no, I don't have time to do that. I don't even know what that is, right? But then a year later, I see a story about this attorney professor from New York who works on something like the Innocence Project. It may actually be the Innocence Project. Mm-hmm. But he gives his talk to the TED audience. And that afternoon, they organized themselves, the audience who watched his talk, raised money and handed him a check for $3 million the same day. And when I heard that story, I was like, aha, that's how I'll help Africa get telescopes. I'll apply to be a TED Fellow. I'll tell them I have this project, and the audience is going to give me $1 million, right? Because I'm going to tell them how cheap it is. That didn't happen. They didn't give me the money. But other amazing things did happen, because when I put that out there, many people from around African nations contacted me saying, I want to get a telescope, and I helped them out. Because there is a big problem when I started doing it, and that's export control laws. You can't just send, you know, technology anywhere. And even the South Pacific nations, you know, I went to the Cook Islands to observe the total solar eclipse and got to know the people there, you know, and the skies were amazing out there, right? In the island of Mangaia. And also, if you look at what science is today, astronomy, you can do the main project that was discovering planets from the ground. The telescope was like 5 inches. You don't need a big telescope. So my colleague, Ray O'Neill, and I, we did a calculation of how many telescopes exist in the northern hemisphere that could do this work, and how many exist in the southern hemisphere outside of the countries that normally do this, you know, Chile, Australia, South Africa. And in the northern hemisphere is tens of thousands, mm-hmm. 8-inch telescopes, 10-inch telescopes, 12-inch. Southern hemisphere, very little. And also it has a big impact on societies. What this type of science does for the national identity.
It's the major engaging kind of a project or a program that can really pull people into wanting to do something really astonishing.
Exactly. And it's visible. You see the you see the observatory up there. It's
sure.
a visible
right.
thing. Images actually show up, right?
Yes.
And so
right.
so now I think Burkina Faso has a 1 meter telescope. Ethiopia has a 1 meter telescope on Mount Entebbe. There's a telescope in Namibia. Rwanda's interested. Tanzania is interested. Zambia, you know, I was in Zambia. You know, even though it's flat for the most part, the sky was nuts. It was, you know, it was unbelievable.
Well, there's that resource of sky availability in these other places is really enormous,
it
especially
is.
In consideration of dark sky availability. It's
exactly.
just crazy. So for that reason, again, you don't need a really big telescope because
exactly.
you have really dark, dark skies.
Exactly.
Lots of stuff
exactly.
can be done.
And the southern hemisphere sky is so much more beautiful.
So much richer.
Happening,
yeah,
than
yeah,
the northern hemisphere sky.
Yep.
So for those of us not fortunate enough to avail ourselves of the beautiful southern hemisphere skies, Derek, what's available to be seen in the night sky this week?
Planets are looking great this time of year. Mars is still ruling the evening sky just after sunset over in the southwest. It's easy to see. It has a hidden companion not far away, the planet Uranus. You'll need a telescope to see it, but as you go out and view Mars, just keep in mind that a little bit to the right and a little bit below Mars, you'll find the planet Uranus. And then for those that are up in the morning before sunrise, your time shift now is to observe between 5:30 and 6 a.m. when you can see three gorgeous planets over in the southeastern portion of the sky. There's Venus, there's Jupiter, and there's Saturn. If you look tomorrow morning, what you'll find is that Venus and Saturn are almost right next to each other, and on Monday morning they will be right next to each other, and you'll be able to watch them as they pass each other through the next several weeks.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Hakeem Olusheyi, astrophysicist, cosmologist, inventor, professor, and author, and Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Sky Talk.